The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 136, a panel discussion entitled, We Are Many Parts, We Are All One Body.
Start at 11:15 and quit promptly at 11:45, and I'm one to always play by the rules, so I will try to stay on target here. Growing up in the inner city of Milwaukee, as I did, one doesn't learn much about Utah or Salt Lake City. What I did learn was that it was the home of the Great Salt Lake and the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. So when I moved my family to Utah in 1978, actually on the house hunting trip, and the realtors, homeowners, and school officials inquired of me, are you a member of the church? I replied very naively, yes, I go to church. I didn't recognize the significance of that question at the time. Well, my journey here has ensued, and it consistently has brought me back to Matthew, who writes, we are many parts, we are all one body. We Catholics add a phrase to that in a song we sing at Mass, and that is, the gifts we have, we are given to share. African shaman, Melinda Somme wrote, too many people jump into spirituality as a shelter to hide from reality. It doesn't work that way. The way it works is for the spirit behind you to follow you wherever you go. Reading and listening and dialoguing about the recent violent events in society has brought out the fact that many of the perpetrators of these events have the feeling that they're estranged, they're different, they've been excluded. And the concept of life in a community with a predominant faith population, be that LDS in Utah or Catholic in Boston, might contribute to a stressor that leads to this. So over the years, I've had individual discussions with each of these panel members regarding this or a variation of this theme. Each panel member comes from a faith perspective, very diverse from my own, and yet we have very much in common, and we've worked together in the mental health community effectively. I have respect both clinically and spiritually for each of their professions and the dimensions of spirituality they follow, so we will be firm ground. The plan today, then, is for each of the panel members to open with a position, after which the panel will dialogue on how to achieve unity in spite of our differences. We will then conclude with a question and answer period. I hope this schedule will work for you. First, I'd like to introduce the panel members to you, and again, express my gratitude to each of them for participating today. Directly to my left is Damaris Methner. Damaris is a licensed clinical psychologist who practices with us at the University of Utah Neuropsychiatric Institute and offices in the Red Butte Clinics building. She is a member of Congregation Kol Ami, the Jewish synagogue in Salt Lake City. She's a lifetime member of Hadassah, a Jewish women's healing organization, and she has published many articles and papers dealing with diversity awareness, multicultural therapy relationships, and other related topics. She will be presenting in Washington, D.C. at the International Therapy Conference, as well as an international conference in Italy next year. She's married to Steve Methner, a psychiatrist, and she's the mom of a son and a daughter. Tom O'Mahony, sitting next to Damaris, is a Catholic priest and a licensed clinical social worker. Father Tom grew up in Sharon, Pennsylvania. He has a degree in English from the University of Dayton, an MA in communications from New York University, and an MSW from the University of Chicago. After completing his Master of Divinity from Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, Tom was ordained to the priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church. Coming to Utah, Tom has worked in the Diocese of Salt Lake, where he ministers to the Korean Catholic community and teaches and counsels high school students and parents at the new Juan Diego Catholic High School due to open next fall. Get that all confused.
I kind of like that.
Can I go back to high school?
We're off to a good start.
Tom has been working with us at the University of Utah Neuropsychiatric Institute and is an LCSW for the past several years. I met Tom Goldsmith at Channel 4, of all places, We were both asked to do a show around the holiday time, and our discussion was so incredibly intense and exciting that I was looking for more opportunities to be able to work with him. He's the minister at the First Unitarian Church on 13th East in Salt Lake City, and his ability to cross the spiritual divides made him a natural to invite to come to be part of this presentation. Finally, given the topic I'm committed to, a concept I'm personally committed to, it seemed important to invite a member of the LDS faith to participate in this discussion. Don Corbett is a licensed clinical social worker and also practices psychotherapy in the Red Butte Clinic building on the campus at the University of Utah. As my mentor in the field of social work, Don guided and taught me most of what I know, and through the years, we have had some very intense conversations, not only about clinical matters, but spiritual matters also. Don is a member of the LDS faith, an incredible teacher, and a true example of a bridge between many ideologies. I'm going to turn the time over to Damaris now.
As we discussed the other day in preparation for this panel, we were talking about the wounds that we've experienced in this community, the joys that we've experienced being a part of this community here in Salt Lake City, the history. Some of you may know that there were pioneer Jews who had Hebrew brands on their cattle as they lived out here in the West, and that there are generations of Jewish families who've lived here in this town and participated in the civil and the religious concerns of this community. In the Jewish belief, there's a word called tikkun olam, which is the repair of the world. And the idea is that to engage in the repair of the world is to experience a joy higher than the highest heaven. And I think for my family, when we've been here, when we've participated together in this community with others, that's been the most important thing that's brought us together. When my daughter was a little girl, her tricycle was burned on our front lawn. And I remember the fear that I felt the day that that happened. And then my husband and I going to speak to the families and the young men who'd done that. And I think that day when we went to talk to them, I was terrified because I thought, you know, if my daughter's tricycle has been burned, what will be next? That was one of the hardest times I've had in this valley, is that particular day. As we spoke to the families, I think they realized that the depth of that particular act on our family and other families in our neighborhood out in Holiday came to us and talked to us later. Part of what is happening in this valley right now is a wish, I think, among certain peoples that there is a sharing, there is a shared wish to repair the world and our little world that exists here. Because I do work with persons who've got anxieties and disturbances, one of the things that I've come to believe is that depression is when a person has lost their story, because part of what I do in my clinical work is recovering a person's story, and part of that is spirit, and part of that is their connection with those who are other than their own faith, whether my client be LDS, be Jewish, be a person who's Muslim. I was a professor at BYU for 6 years, and my clientele down there were students of other faith. That was the broad caption that went over those persons, and international students. And I learned the variation of people that are in the LDS religion. A Chinese woman who's converted to the LDS church and left her children in order to establish a lifeline to her family is going to be different than someone who was raised here in Salt Lake. So part of the personal stories that I hear every day are related to this entwining of one another. And like I've said, it can either be woven into a tapestry or we can trip on all the threads. So it's within each of us how that all turns out.
Thank you, Damaris. I'm Father Tom, and would just like, as was mentioned in the introduction by Mary, I was Mary Talboys. I was born and raised in a small town called Sharon, Pennsylvania. Sharon, Pennsylvania is on the western part of PA, near Pittsburgh, actually. And I am. My father was one of 12 children of an Irish immigrant family, and his uncle, my great uncle. This was in the farm community, was the pastor of a Catholic church which bordered my family's farm for 50 years. So I came from a culture which was very Catholic, which was very little other than Catholic, and which understood things Catholic. So I think my background actually has many similarities to many of the people here in Salt Lake City, only that religion is not Catholicism, it is LDS. So I'm real happy to be here, and from that point of departure, I begin. I did my social work study at the University of Chicago, and it was a very interesting program because traditionally in social work practice, there has been a great differentiation between what is spiritual and what is clinical. And I'm part of this test study to see what it's like to combine the two. So my class consisted of seminarians of various denominations, Christian and non-Christian denominations. And there we learned social work practice along with spiritual components. It was very interesting because in the seminary we had certain concepts and we called it A, B, and C. In social work school we had the same concepts and we called it 1, 2, and 3. So it's being able to integrate the two. After our meeting together here recently, I went back up on the floor. I work as a clinical social worker on the floor in the hospital. And I was leading a group, the psychotherapy group, and this one young gentleman talked about how he felt that people were able to see into his soul. And I said, this is just what I need to talk about here. And so I immediately jotted it down on the board, and I said, would you please help me prepare this presentation? And they said, sure. So this presentation, or these issues, these concepts, these realities that I would like to share with you are the direct product of a group I've recently led. And so the seven people who contributed to this presentation are with us here in spirit right now. In order to be, according to this group, in order to be members of one body and functioning parts to be together, we have to be able to see into someone else's soul. And the components that we came up with during that group, which I invite you to think about, and then we can talk about at a later point if you so choose and if there's time, are these 8 points. Number one, a sense of personal pride. In order to cooperate and collaborate with somebody else and to expand our understandings, we have to have our own sense of personal pride. Number two is validation. We all have the same feelings, regardless how they are expressed or what precipitates them. Feelings, the scope of human feelings are very universal, and they're very general. They're very specific to each of us. Validation. Number three was the combination of the expression of compassion with understanding. We have to be compassionate, really, in order to understand. Number four, which is the issue that all of the group participants found the most difficult to implement, is being kind and gentle with oneself. Number five involves vulnerability. We need to protect our vulnerability, know when and where it is wise to be vulnerable, but nonetheless experience in this reaction or in this condition of being vulnerable, because that creates trust. Number six is mutuality, taking a risk to be with someone in their own space, boundaries. Number seven is trust. And the group delineated trust into two kinds of trust. Social trust, being able to chat with somebody, smiling someone, general surface trust, and soul trust. Shared with a few, it's earned, and it involves intimacy. Number eight is conditional versus unconditional love. According to the group, Group A at the University of Utah Neuropsychiatric Institute this past week, these are the eight steps that we need to engage in, and I agree with them, in order to transcend boundaries of difference.
Hi, I'm Tom Goldsmith, and I was born and raised in New York City, in the Big Apple, and was there from birth through undergraduate school experiences, and then went off to Boston for 15 years. And then after a while, I thought, my goodness, this was just too easy, being a minister of a liberal religion in the liberal Northeast. And I went to our headquarters, and I said, gee, don't you have something a little more challenging? Be careful what you wish for, I guess. But it's been a pleasure serving the First Unitarian Church here for 12 years. I had a little difficulty really getting my hands, getting a grasp on the subject of diversity, because being born New Yorker, I mean, you don't think about diversity. One lives in a hodgepodge, melting pot. Every day is just filled with all sorts of diversity, and so I had to step back a little bit and say, okay, how do we approach this? And what I want to start out with, just to get a handle on it, is a wonderful story, a true story that Joseph Campbell relays. And I think this is important because I first want to get an understanding of the concept of diversity, just generally speaking, just the generic, what does that mean? And then we can look at issues of diversity right here in Utah and more specifically in Salt Lake City. Joseph Campbell tells the story, this goes back a number of years, I guess it's in the 70s, where there's an ecumenical meeting at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and the purpose of that meeting was to welcome the Dalai Lama to New York. And the host was Cardinal Cook, who was the cardinal there in St. Patrick's, and it says, and Campbell says, the most fascinating experience. Here they are sitting around this conference table, and everything is very congenial. Everything is really nice, and the Dalai Lama is, of course, the honored guest, and so he says the obligatory couple of nice things, and so he gets up and says how happy he is to be in New York, how happy he is to be in St. Patrick's Cathedral, and how nice to be sitting here around the table with all these different faiths and different traditions, and then goes on in a very, you would think, just a very easy, non-threatening way, saying how all the traditions really have the same end in mind, and the traditions just represent various approaches to a common end. Well, there was, on one level, a really nice show of accord around that conference table, but Cardinal Cook was getting noticeably uncomfortable, and he said, Dalai Lama, it's so wonderful to have you here and what you say, but you know, I can't really agree that, you know, all the faiths really share the, you know, the same thing, because as Roman Catholics, we feel that that we have, you know, the one truth. We possess the one truth. And then some evangelical ministers were there and interrupted the cardinal and said, well, excuse me, cardinal, but we feel that we possess the truth. And a rabbi was there as well, and he said, whoa, my Christian brothers, let me, I think I, you know. And it was just, you know, an incredible scene. Joseph Campbell describes it this way. He said, they're all sitting around the table as though they're playing cards. and they're holding the cards pretty close to the vest. And every one of them thought that he was holding the trump card. So what does it feel like for a non-Mormon in Utah living under the influence, in this case, under the influence of the LDS trump card? So we all understood the assignment a little bit different, Mary, and so,
that's okay.
The trump card, I think, is not just the Mormon belief that it owns the one sole truth of how this magnificent cosmos really works. The thing is, when an authoritative church has the power of politics at its disposal through the overwhelming sheer numbers, then the consequence is that the moral fibers of the community are colored by the trump card. And so, let me just say how I feel the moral fibers of this community are distinctly colored by LDS sensibilities, by the LDS power. A, just permeating our culture, attitude towards women, their subversive role in the family and society, and as a consequence of that, we have, I think, just an appalling dearth of child care facilities based primarily on this moral principle that women belong in the home, and so on. You know the story. Secondly, the attitudes towards gays and lesbians and transgendered people, which, as a consequence, has led to unsafe schools, as we have seen in East High School in particular. The firing of Wendy Weaver is another case in point. Let's go on and on and on. The prohibitionist view on alcohol, which impacts the whole restaurant and hotel business, makes downtown life singularly dull, and will cause us to be the laughingstock of the whole world when the Olympics arrive here in 2002. Not even the press corps will be able to have a drink when they set up right here at the Salt Palace. I'm thinking about establishing something at the Unitarian Church to have the press corps go there and just kind of have, or at least a tavern for the press corps and shuttle buses. I don't know. So we're working on it. It's a golden opportunity for the Unitarians right here. A repressive atmosphere here where nude paintings are forcibly removed from a library. Rodin's The Kiss can't be exhibited while on tour at a university. Theater and music are tightly bound by LDS moral guidelines. Censorship is common practice in the schools. Full credit given to students who attend seminary. And don't forget, as you probably all read in last Saturday's Tribune, don't forget the church's desire to cripple Sunstone itself, fearful of the intellectual inquiry and questions which probe Mormon beliefs and practices which are hopelessly out of date with the times. Holding the trump card in morals and politics, the church does what it pleases, even when it comes to the public square, the acquisition of Main Street by the LDS Church to create a huge downtown LDS campus is case in point. In an age of growing awareness of multiculturalism, and where even in Utah, diversity is making an impact, you may recall reading a story about Park City, where one half of the kindergarten kids enrolled in the schools in Park City are Spanish speaking. I mean, so the diversity is kind of, can't even say it's creeping into our midst. It is there. So we are aware, at least, you know, intellectually, multiculturalism is all over the states, and in particular, even diversity is being felt here in Salt Lake City or in Zion. There is no evidence, and this is the sadness that I feel, there's no evidence that the keepers of the trump card here in Utah, the LDS authorities, there's no evidence that they are prepared to do some very serious community building where socially and morally we gain a more equitable sense among the various cultures who choose to make this their home. Now, back to the Dalai Lama, you know, and his underlying thesis that, you know, there really is a commonality amongst the traditions, you know, which was challenged because, oh, we have the truth, we have the truth. But let's go back to perhaps this sense of a commonality amongst all religious traditions. I gave that some thought, and I came up with, you know, what is there a unifying thread? And the closest that I came to was perhaps something like the Golden Rule. The Hebrew Bible, Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, that ought to be kind of the touchstone to get a wonderful sense of community. Well, it's not just the Hebrew Bible, as we all know. In the Gospel of Luke, we find it phrased this way, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And then there's the negative formulation according to Confucius. What you do not want done to yourself, do not do unto others. Okay? Then in the 3rd century before the Common Era, in the Tobit, which is an apocryphal book of the Hebrew Bible, we find, and this is perhaps that's the clearest message, what you hate, do not do to anyone. At the time of Jesus, Rabbi Hillel said, what is hateful to you, do not do to anyone else. Now, this is all common sense, isn't it? In other words, there are social implications to one's belief system. You know, you may think that yours is the only one absolute truth in the universe. That's fine. But the next step is to realize the inherent moral demands of your religious beliefs. That sounds simple enough, but the reason I think it's so hard to do this, and that we actually have a community and we are a body with many parts, I think the reason it's so hard is, we can find the answer to this in the Bible, in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, verse 48. Powerful line. Set no bounds on your love, just as your heavenly Father set none on his. Set no bounds on your love. It's that easy. It's that hard. We are all of us, too quick to set boundaries on our neighbor, set limits on those whom we should love. And although the inherent worth and dignity of all people is implicit in probably every sacred text, if we're honest, our love is a qualified love. We restrict our love to what we feel is safe. We restrict our love to those people whom we know. And so as a result, we come up with good rationalizations for denying women equal rights, denying people of color the priesthood, denying the rights of homosexuals even to exist. The trump card held by a powerful and dominant religion poses problems for all who adhere to a different morality, a different faith, a different set of sensibilities. It would prove to be the ultimate act of graciousness if the dominant religion and others could work together and build community sensitive to a wider morality which is currently in place. How do we start this? My humble suggestion would be, why don't we go back and revisit East High School? That's, as far as I'm concerned, just a microcosm of how split we are and how fearful we are of diversity in other points of view. So in closing, I believe the most constructive contribution to this in any discussion about diversity must include one thing in particular, and that is humility. Our own humility. First and foremost, we must be willing to reduce the truth to a small t. How else could we ever really listen to others? And unless we entertain the possibility, just the possibility that someone else's perspective may be right, we might as well just save our breath and close off all discussions of diversity. Humility was what was lacking among all the clergy back at St. Patrick's a few decades ago. Humility is what's lacking today here in Salt Lake, in particular, as we try to build a more inclusive community.
My thanks to Mary, my good friend. I honor her and revere her and see her as a real positive force and creative force in this community. And I thank her for her friendship and for her good spirit. I also am grateful today for this opportunity to share with you some of my feelings relative to what I feel is a very interesting and challenging system of statements. A very interesting and challenging approach to what I consider to be a city that is a little bit different than has been described. Of course, I'm in the midst of it. I must admit, though, that in my high priest group, there have been times when I have tried to bring up creative ideas, and I have been looked down upon in a fairly judgmental way. And so there are certain things within our religion where, or certain people within our religion who are extremely judgmental, extremely iron rod like, and I would like to tell a article I read years ago in Dialogue, which I treasure, article by Richard Pohl, where he said, who was a stake president and wrote the biography of Hugh B. Brown, who was a good man. I think Tom would have enjoyed him. Good man, a man who was open to all truth and open to all discussion as to what things are about. He said, in any given ward, you will find two groups of people. You will find the iron rod type person or group. Those are the people who see the Word of God as black and white. And that is the way it is, and come heck or high water, that's the way it'll be. And they, in turn, dishonor the agency of others and push very hard to have that principle placed in the lives of other people. And on the other side, you have the Liahona types. The Liahona is a compass-like device. It's talked about in the Book of Mormon, which is a directional device that points the way, according to the Liahona-type Mormons, points the way to the Word of God as to where we should go and how we should get there without violating the agency of other people and the rights of other people. And then I got to thinking there's still more to be said in regard to that article, and that is that the Savior was a beautiful balance between those two extremes. In the New Testament, he spent most of his time more to the Liahona side, where he encouraged, admonished, recommended, pled, tried to get people to understand what he was talking about, and did not violate agency, did not put people down, but did speak with the truth, and he spoke in certain absolute terms about what he was about. He did not, I don't believe, prescribe to situational ethics of the time that was very profound in his work. But He also was an iron rod type person in that he cleansed the temple of the money changers and drove them out in a very methodical way because, as you know, he braided the whip, and therefore it was a proactive, not reactive response to those people that were defiling the temple. And so I think Richard Pohl has a great point to make, that we as LDS people, those of us who are LDS people, should be very balanced and grounded in that center position and stand firm relative to things that are absolute, and also be very loving and kind and understanding in regard to those things that we feel are very important, like loving our neighbor. I recall just moving in the last year and a half, leaving my very dear Jewish friend, neighbor Mike Siegel, a man whom I love and still love. When we left each other, there was a parting that was very, very tender. And I still consider him to be one of the finest men I know. Fortunately, my mother and my father taught me how to love, not conditionally, but to love from the heart and the soul. And they showed that by their own actions toward every other person they met and toward me. And so I was fortunate because they brought me close to Christ. And then when I read Carl Rogers' philosophy about how to connect with people, I was delighted. He said we should have empathy. We should seek to understand the feelings and thoughts of others and look into their hearts and understand what they're feeling. He said we should have positive regard for those people, a genuine positive regard. We should show non-possessive warmth toward those people. We should be non-judgmental relative to those people that we work with, whom we work. And I add to that, we should have a great deal of intuition that guides and directs us relative to the timing of certain situations relative to therapy and in our relationships with other people. And as an LDS person, I add to that intuition the gift of the Holy Ghost, which to me is indispensable relative to the work that I do, because that adds to my intuitive sense as to what's going on. Mary's approach to today's theme. And I add to the African shaman by saying and quoting from a real hero of mine, Nelson Mandela, who spent, as you know, 25 years or more locked up by white people because of his courageous soul and heart. But what did he do when he walked out of that prison? He loved people. The Lord said, be therefore perfect in your love of others. Perfect, translated by the Greek, from the Greek word, means to be whole or complete or finished. Mandela was whole and complete, having gone through a situation where he endured humility, endured being put down, endured being judged harshly. But from that endurance, he learned a great deal. He learned how to love everyone. And as a result, in 1994, in his inaugural address, he gave this marvelous talk, which I think says everything about what we should be about. And it relates to my feeling as to what Mormonism is about in terms of the worth of the soul or the inherent nature of each person, in that we are gods and goddesses as an embryo, in that we as individuals have within us a sense of the eternal, a sense of a part of the eternal nature of God. He said, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are not a child of God. Pardon me, you are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightening about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It is not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And that, I believe, that is what we believe. And as we let our lights shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Talk about a beautiful statement that relates to Mary's marvelous reference as to being whole, as to being complete. And I close with some universal truths that cross all boundaries, which I believe in and try to live as an individual. Granted, there are some iron rotters in our community that offend, that do terrible things. Iron rod Mormons and probably maybe some iron rod people in other faiths that do offend, who are not maybe as secure as they need to be, as the Savior was or as Moses was. But I believe in these truths, which I try to honor. First of all, an understanding. Next, honor, esteeming oneself, honoring others, esteeming God. Integrity. As Lowell Bunyan said, integrity encompasses all the virtues. Endurance. Nelson Mandela did endure. He endured well. Endurance is a teacher. It can teach us what we need to know and what we need to be taught. Commitment. Commitment. I commit to absolute truth. I believe in absolute truth. The most fascinating video I ever watched in the last 2 years was Einstein Revealed, where he struggled to find absolute truth. The absolute truth about gravity. The absolute truth about light. The absolute truth about the universe. And only when he started to think as God thought and how God would create the universe did he really start to move. Did he really start to understand. And things started to unfold. So he was committed to finding the truth, an absolute truth. I believe in compassion, empathy, and sensitivity, as I've mentioned. Mercy versus judgment and criticism. At times, my good wife, if she were here, would say, yeah, Don, at times you're very judgmental and you're very critical, and that's true. I remember my young son saying one day as I was watching a football stairs, he was running up the stairs, he ran out the front door, I ran out the front door, and then I started to think, what are you doing? You are a jerk. And I told John, with tears in his eyes, that I was being a jerk as a father. I will never forget that. I'm sure John has never forgotten that. But at times we are jerks. And we do get judgmental and we do get critical. And then finally, the truth of harmony. If we honor these other truths, we will come to a sense of harmony. A sense of loving in a complete way. Loving others without judging. Loving in trying to understand the position of others. Loving in the way that Nelson Mandela came to understand as he endured probably things that we can't even comprehend. And so I feel very fortunate today to be able to represent the gospel of Jesus Christ and Mormonism, and that which I believe, and that which has served our family well. I am married. We have 5 children. Four married. One is about to be married. And they are good souls. We love each other. We have a strong family. And I love my good wife. And the direction that we have received from that we believe has served us well. And I apologize for those people who have offended, those people in the church who have offended those in the community in such a way that they feel so harshly about that which I feel has value, has goodness, and there are some absolutes within that which we believe. Again, I thank you for this opportunity, and I hope that we can continue from here in a very stimulating discussion.
I want to share with you that in my usual way of doing things, I didn't bring this group together until 2 days ago, and then we all had very serious time constraints, so we spent the first little bit of time talking about the donuts and what have you, and we got to talking about how we were going to put this together. There wasn't much of a sense of direction, and yet I think every one of them spoke about the very commonality and the very part that does make us whole and make us one, which was totally unplanned and certainly came from the heart and the spirit. So I'd like to kind of open it up for discussion now as to how each of us who have the same platform and you can come together and work to bring that unity into our community so that we are whole and not divisive.
I think one of the things that's going on with teenagers that my daughter's involved in is Anytown USA, and it has supporters from all religious backgrounds and from all the tribes in the state. And that's the National Conference for Community and Justice has those up at a camp in Ogden. They get together teenagers from all over the state, and they talk about their experiences, their biases towards one another. And my daughter's done that for several years. She's been a counselor up there. That's a wonderful opportunity. National Conference for Community and Justice. It used to be called National Conference of Christians and Jews.
Yeah. Can I try to answer that? I think I know exactly what you're saying and the question you raise. And it kind of relates a little bit to what Don was saying. You know, that there are certainly, you know, as in any faith tradition, there are some very kind and generous people, and then there are those who are a little more rigid. But specifically to your question, I think it's kind of a two-tier response. One is that you've got the institutional position, and then you have the kindness and generosity of some of its members. A case in point would be in our last capital campaign at the First Unitarian Church. It was John Huntsman's foundation who gave us a very generous check. And it was done in a very loving way. Nobody was in the least bit suspicious about motives. In fact, John Huntsman Jr. came to our worship service and presented a check and just endeared everyone to him. We were rolling the aisle. He had some very funny stories, and the punchline of the whole thing was that his father wanted to make absolutely sure to communicate to everyone that Salt Lake City had to be more than just a one church town. And he got a standing ovation, and that's a very generous act by one individual. Institutionally, I run into problems over and over again. And perhaps the nub of the problem, which was after a couple of years of just really feeling like I was knocking my head against the wall, the nub of the problem was explained to me by a former LDS bishop who said, You as a minister, as all ministers, as all clergy in town are suspect because until very recently in LDS teaching, ministers are seen as or viewed as agents of the devil. And so I was wondering why I was having these difficulties, for example, visiting a parishioner in prison when anywhere else in the country you have special clergy privileges to, now, forget it. The attitude was one of just, it was just...
Not a prisoner?
Even a Unitarian will go to jail now and again. Yeah. I'm ashamed to admit that, yeah.
Need the diversity.
Exactly right. Yeah, but you understand what I'm saying. So you've got some very generous and gracious LDS community leaders, and then you've got the institution.
Have you seen the institutional outreaches as genuine or just PR?
I'd like to address that, if I may. Is your name Sue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
From the Catholic tradition, you may know that our Cathedral of the Madeleine, which is on South Temple, was recently renovated. A good portion of that money was LDS money. So I think that's a very interesting combination of institutional outreach and individual personal outreach. And similarly, in the parish house adjacent to the cathedral, we have what's called the Good Samaritan Program. And the Good Samaritan Program gives away about, conservatively, 350 to 500 bag lunches a day. Much of that food is purchased through the LDS Church. So I think we're beginning.
And it's
starting. We're at the beginning, yeah. I think we need to be kind and gentle with ourselves and in our desires to see this collaboration, because certainly it has begun. And I was impressed. I've been here 3.5 years. I came from Chicago, and like Tom, I lived in New York City for 20 years. I was very impressed that you walk into the cathedral. Everyone's invited to the cathedral. It's a great church, even if architecturally and artistically. Very impressed that was done through the generosity of the LDS Church. So it's both.
You have an answer to your question.
Well, the motives.
Well, I think there's probably a combination of reasons. I think for X number of dollars, hardcore money to be given, I think that's it's sort of casual just to write that off. I think there is a movement to collaborate more than in previous times. That's
when,
my view.
When Itzhak Rabin was assassinated over in Israel, that happened on a Sunday, and on a Monday, when we had our services at the synagogue, the prophet and his wife Marjorie, they came to the synagogue. And I really believe that was the prophet's decision to come. There was certainly there was so much concern in the Jewish community going on that we weren't thinking about who's worrying about this, who's concerned about this. But he showed up. And we were very, very grateful to him to do that. Yes?
It seems to me, look what could happen. It looks like you're lending fuel to the rumor that God might love everyone.
What a concept.
Thank you. Yes, sir?
I apologize.
I think we start with small groups like this, and each one of those groups goes out and tells someone about that, and maybe the room will be twice as filled next year because it has to start with one person reaching out. That's a wonderful comment. Thank you. Kathy, you had a question.
I think, for me personally, I'm very practical on many levels and get, you know, way out there spiritually lots of times. But any, you know, for children, when they're getting together and they're playing and they're doing something together, for women, I know that before the AIDS epidemic, there was a request from the university hospital that certain women help out with the baby who needed a kidney transplant. And we were to deliver milk, mother's milk,
for that baby, and it was over the holidays, and we were all from a range of spiritual backgrounds, and all of us were contributing to that, and that was one of the most wonderful things that all of us women did together, and this baby was thriving. And so anytime you participate in a focused, cooperative situation that transcends your own personal self, it happens. It happens with my children, who are no longer children, but when they had experiences like that.
Yeah, and I mentioned my neighbor, Mike Siegel. The day we moved in, we were friends, it seemed. We connected. We were able to talk. His good wife died rather prematurely. Mike invited us to her services, and we were always very close. We never did talk too much about, as I said, religion, but we talked about each other. We talked about helping each other. We talked about sports. We talked about life. Mike was always talking about our children. His children had grown. I asked questions about his life, how he was doing after his wife died, and did a lot of things to help. And he helped us. And so it was a very, very positive relationship. In no way did I impose upon him my value system. In no way did he impose upon me his value system. We simply were connected soul to soul. And it felt real good, and it still feels good. And I miss him.
Tom.
Can I respond to that? No. I think what the LDS Church can do to really help is to, and this may be an impossibility, but I think it's really key. They need to acknowledge that there's more than one morality in a society. And I'll give you two concrete examples. One, from 1990 to 1993, I was on the governor's task force for exploring child care in Salt Lake City with a very ecumenical group. And that's where I met Father Bob Bussin, with whom I have a tremendous admiration for. It was chaired by LDS woman from Utah State University. And so it was an ecumenical group and so on and so forth. And the issue was, we've got, even in this culture, despite the Mormon views, strong views on the family and the role of women in the family, the truth is there are almost 70% of LDS women who work. And so they need to drop off their children in daycare facilities. Most of the daycare facilities are being run by Protestant churches. And it is really hard for people, especially new people coming in, to find child care. And a very simple suggestion was made. Can't we open up some wards, strategic areas? My God, the issue go away. And it was, they would not move. They say, no, it is wrong. Women belong in the home. And if they want to go out to work, that's fine. And the clergy would argue and say, let's be realistic about this. The point is, one pervasive morality, and regardless, even if it doesn't make sense in the light of statistics and how we run our lives here, that morality prevails. Another case in point has to do with a horrible situation along the East Bench where a lot of teachers who are gay or lesbian are, this is not my word, but from the superintendent of schools here, on the hit list. Parents are threatening the jobs of teachers who have insignia in their classroom that says diversity is honor diversity, or have a rainbow, emblem. And this is, and these are all, this may be your iron rod Mormons. And the point is, you've got
the worst.
Okay, now. So you can say every faith will have a very narrow-minded group of people. The superintendent of schools, Dr. Robles, has tried, because we've been working on this for a while, to get an appointment with some key people at LDS authorities. And every day, she tries every day to make an appointment, is denied. Because they know what the agenda is. and it is simply to open up a wider view that says that a different kind of morality is possible. And how can the LDS authorities acquiesce to that when at the same time they're pouring millions of dollars into Hawaii, Alaska, California, because their position is really clear? I don't think we're going to, other than individual acts of generosity, and when I hear Don and his relationship with his neighbor, I mean, that could be multiplied by a million, because there are some wonderful, when I moved into my neighborhood, my realtor described it as a mixed neighborhood. And I was looking for people of color, and I realized what she meant was, there are Mormons and non-Mormons. So as significant and as wonderful and powerful as that one-to-one relationship is, and there's no way I want to diminish that, I mean, that's really all we have to go on. Institutionally, that's when push comes to shove.
But your question is going to be asked of the church.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is it has to come from the community. So if a community group could get organized of all the different faiths and then represent the community with the different organizations and the different institutions, then you have some power and you have a spokesperson who represents the citizens agree on the communities, no matter what community, whether it's a regional community or a common community or whatever. But I think until it comes from the citizens themselves, and to be a representative to the LDS institution, because the institution listens to the greater future and they listen to their membership, but it's so much more powerful to take the community to the leadership.
Do they listen to Sunstone?
No.
Well, okay.
Sunstone has not really been able to focus on how to reach the institution in a profile. So I'm saying it takes a lot of creative thinking.
I would just quickly like to address it, if I may. I come from, or I represent an institution which has been around about 2,000 years. And the institution is always the last one to change. It always comes from the grassroots up. So therefore, the one-to-one approach, as I see it, is kind of what we're working with. And I sort of join my peers here in focusing on children. I think if LDS mothers were encouraged to encourage their children to play with individuals, children of other faith, and to invite them into dinner and to forget this barrier. I'm working in a school now, so I hear these stories all the time. It's interesting when Catholic schools become the alternative school. It's like, I always thought that we were the church. But anyway, I think it's with the kids, really.
Yes. And there's a whole curriculum, Starting Small. It's called Starting Small for little bitty people. It's at the Teaching Tolerance Project. They have curriculum from little preschoolers all the way up through high school. Videos and teaching materials.
I think if other people seek to impose other goals on the schools, then you fight.
Yes, ma'am.
Who's the publisher?
Teaching Tolerance is 400 Washington Avenue, Montgomery, Alabama, 36104.
This
is Southern Poverty Law Center.
They have some wonderful videos.
Yeah, they have wonderful videos. And they have one of their first videos has the story of the Mormon pioneers and related to a story about freedom of the press and freedom of religion, which is part of one of their videos.
Yeah.
There's a question in the back.
I wonder if, and I'm not being totally facetious, but I wonder if there's a way of creating that catastrophe. But when there is something happening, that we have flood or out in Riverton, there
it's a great point.
And who's asking? Are you Mormon? Are you Catholic? Are you Muslim?
That's great.
If we could create something that would stir people up enough to recognize our commonality, and it wouldn't have to be, if there could be a major joy. I wasn't in favor much of the Olympics, but look what happened when everybody, when the Jazz win, or when anything, if there's some way that we could produce something that would say we need to serve each other, come together, it's like being on the same committee.
That's a wonderful idea, and that's a wonderful perspective, and I don't think there is anything like a cause that brings people together and takes them down that road. Paul?
That just makes me think that maybe there's going to be a purpose for the earthquake.
Oh!
Well, I mean, I think
that
there's something pointed out that this is an ideal forum for breaking down barriers, being close to each other, not wanting to put God on the spot, but anyway. If the church succeeds in their goal of destroying the sunstone, where do we turn next?
Well, I brought that subject up in that priesthood meeting I mentioned, where I wanted to talk openly and honestly about certain issues that weren't acceptable to the majority. And I said we need forums whereby we can talk openly and honestly about issues that might be controversial. And by golly, I got a feeling of, the nonverbal feeling of judgment and disdain and what's wrong with you, et cetera, et cetera. So I really don't know. I mentioned U.B. Brown. He's my wife's great uncle. He at one time was talking with some of the professors at the university, and I'm being honest about this and the church and revealing some of the things about the LDS church that I do not like and I do not condone. But he was encouraged not to talk to these more liberal type professors who were LDS because of certain reasons. Now, I won't say the reasons. I suspect, well, I know what they might be, but he was discouraged in doing that, and he discontinued doing that. He was, U.B. Brown was my father-in-law's very favorite person, so I know of his story, I know of his situation. And I can't say, I don't know why the hierarchy or the upper-level areas of the church, those people who are maybe more iron rod-like, have such an aversion to open discussion like this, because I love it. I think Mary will attest to the fact that we could talk openly and we could talk about things that are controversial and still be friends. And so it shouldn't be so threatening. If the LDS Church is true, it should survive any kind of examination. And so I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that there are a lot of there are certain members in the Quorum of the Twelve who are very iron rodded. President U.B. Brown. That's why I said to you, I think you'd love him. Those of you who didn't know him. He was not. He was more a homolite. He was more open to discussions like this. And I think he would be in favor of it. I don't know if Elder Maxwell might be one of those who might be open to maybe visiting or talking to as to what an alternative might be. Pardon me?
Elder Morris.
Yes, Julie.
I was going to bring up an idea. The sad thing about churches being divisive rather than bringing people together, even though there's all these common goals or even the Eastern religions, there's a lot of common themes. Taking care of what Don was saying about we all are a part of God and all this, and yet look at what happens in the world.
with all the fighting. I mean, that's an example of, to me, the destructiveness that can happen with being the only one or the right one.
There's a marvelous video that I mentioned to the committee that I saw last week on C-SPAN 1 or 2 by Bill Moyers, who had a panel, Catholic woman who was moving toward Buddhism, Bill Moyers, who was Catholic and fairly strong in his position relative to the Catholic Church and the Holy Wars and so forth. And there was a black minister, very, very bright, a Chinese teacher of Confucius thought, mainly, and Muslim, and a female rabbi. Most fascinating talk about some of this and what you're talking about and what happens when certain people get together in a certain way and believe a certain thing and do things that are unjust. And they ended up with a lot of discussion, but not too many solutions. But it was a marvelous experience to watch this discussion.
I sense that if Sunstone is no more, this group of people who are committed to it will find a way to have the second generation of Sunstone and call it Moonlight. I don't know. But somewhere along the line, those people seeking the truth and unity will find a way, even if it's in groups 2, 3, 10, 20. You made the commitment to come and learn about this. Your commitment to this concept is obviously very evident. Yes, sir.
You know, perhaps small town dynamics is a little different than Carolina Wasatch Front. I come from a small town in the center of Utah, which is probably 80% LDS. And, you know, I find a tremendous amount of institutional outreach from the LDS Church to that 20% or 30%. Contrary to the feeling that I get from some of you here, there's a tremendous outreach, not just from individuals, but from the two LDS states that are there. We're in our third year of ecumenical Easter program. I think the thing that we found, perhaps the most difficult, is a sense that the other groups don't want to be overpowered by majority, and sometimes it's almost, for lack of a better word, almost a paranoia on some of the people that we work with that causes the problem. To practice for the Little Easter program. None of the non-LDS groups would come to an LDS award. Although those of us that were LDS felt no problem going to the First Baptist or the Catholic or whatever. And it's been an interesting experience, but I think there's been a lot of outreach, and it's been very positive.
Thanks for sharing that. I hope you're right, that it's
small town
growing.
My
Marianne?
You know, I think we have to realize where the LDS Church has come from. Their new religion is terribly persecuted. And as we see in dysfunctional families, when a child is battered, teachers have to be battered. Mm-hmm. And although I don't know if
that's a great point.
Now, Armstrong makes this connection with the angel and the Levite. Sociologically, he says, you know, when people are there crying and push, mm-hmm. then they tend to turn around and do the same thing. They look for legitimacy. And so, you know, I think to realize why these things are happening is one reason. And then also, our own doctrine tells us that when anyone gets a little bit of power, they tend to abuse it. And I think that's what's happening in the hierarchy of our church here. And to the extent that, or section Sunstone and has a very difficult time surviving. But that's why it's so important that there's something so important that we hang on and that we try to make a difference, like Father Tom said. Institutions change very, very slowly. But I remember the time in this valley when the Mormons didn't have any kind of ecumenical cooperation with other churches. So we're seeing some of that now. Catholic charities and So, you know, individuals can make a difference. We just need to say, you know, I call, I mean, I have children that went to East High, and I called a member of the school board and told them how appalling I thought, you know, this, if, you know, if you make enough noise, it'll be heard.
Well, I think we have to remember none of us grow when things are calm and complacent in our lives. When we grow is when we have to reach and struggle and go beyond. So this is an invitation to move beyond, perhaps. Kathy?
I'd like to make one statement about the millennium. And I think following Evelyn's comment about creating some kind of an event, we've got a huge event coming up, and I think it's a great way for people to start analyzing how they think, how they relate to other people, what they want to change in their lives. And I think we as Mormons and people in this community can take this opportunity to say, hey, you know, we want to change. And I would like to know more about it.
You're on. Yes, sir.
Dr. Goldsmith asked, does the church pay any attention to Sunstone in one of the other sections?
Thank you. Yes, sir.
You know, if I live in a Mormon church, and I'm a Mormon, and I'm not too active now, but I look at their ultimate goal is that every human being takes their own. And from every action they take in the hierarchy of the Mormon church is based on that concept. Mm-hmm. When you talk about outreach in the Mormon church, I look at that outreach. My personal opinion is, the basic view is, to further that goal. That's the only reason the outreach is there, to further that goal. Now, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I am. And I see things happening, you know, for PR purpose of furthering that goal. But going out and saying, okay, I'm going to be nice to you, I'm going to befriend you, I'm going to give you all the goodies that you need in the way of life. You're on this becoming a member, so I'll go over to this one and try this one over here. Now, that is no way to think about unity.
No.
It's just no way to think about unity. Now, maybe other organizations, that's their goal too. Maybe the Catholic, Cheryl, and the goal is that every human being be a Catholic.
No.
I don't know.
No.
I know that's
no.
Religion,
no.
But I do believe that's the Mormon goal.
That could be,
and
but it's not ours.
If I stop that, the hierarchy, there's never going to be a Mormon church and other people.
Yes, sir.
Another complicating factor in situations is that, well, unlike any other place in the United States where there's a dominant religion, in the case of Utah Mormons, there is this sense historically, and I think this sense of surviving the mind of the Bible individual, that you find in Mormon culture, that is where they divinely appointed Mormon culture. I'm thinking of Comfort and the Saints, for instance, there's this place which God or us prepare. And my experience is that being a non-Mormon in Utah means you are a guest. You're not a fellow citizen, you are a guest. And that colors the way people out. Which means the outreach of a gracious host to a gracious guest is not a connection between two.
What a great way to look at it.
It is the one place in the world where we are referred to as Gentiles.
Even the rabbi, he loves that.
Even the rabbi. And there are now three rabbis in this state.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd just like to give an example. Years ago, I'm from Oregon, and in the Jewish field, and we had kind of this mentality that was like a dance work. But, you know, I was in a ward where a bishop, they decided the youth group and then the bishop's commission to invite the youth group from a church in town who was being very active against the Mormons and teaching their kids how to, you know, literally get somebody confused when they were discussing anything with Mormon kids. Well, this group came to the church and we had of course, our sacrament meeting was all about Christ, because we're all about Christian, and probably not the best background that other men do. And then they had a question and answer period afterwards. And it went beautifully. And the crux of it was that we got an invitation to come and be in their service, and our bishop was not honoring the priest at all.
Wow.
And that is, you know, I see that over and over again. In fact, I was going to get my band, but I felt that in a moment. Get the kids privately and take them over there. I was so angry. And her parents said, don't tell me you're in trouble, you don't tell me you're in trouble. And I was such a woman on earth to do it, you know? But that kind of thing is what kills. And let's face it, there's one of these kids.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to just mention, certainly, in terms of change coming from the bottom up or from the top down, President Brown again, B.B. Brown was a counselor to David O. McKay, and David O. McKay got quite ill, and so President Brown became basically the spokesperson for the LDS Church. And I remember when he said at a conference down in San Francisco that the black should have a priesthood. I thought, And it was all, because he was taken into to President Lee, who was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, and he was severely, quote unquote, pruned. And some of you know about the story of Billy Graham being pruned as a young person in the Canadian Army in regard to his wanting to be appointed to be a general, but because he was a Mormon, he wasn't. This is the second pruning he went through by President Lee, because he said to President Brown, look, this is not your place, you're not the prophet, you're not the one who should be stating whether the black should have the priesthood or not. That should come from the Lord. Well, eventually President Kimball said that did happen, and the blacks did get the priesthood, and things did happen. Pardon?
Because of pressure and the grassroots. That was one of the, I know the major factor, but there were a lot of people who were wanting that change.
Well, and he was one. President Brown was one. And he was in the midst of the hierarchy or the upper levels of the LDS Church, where he could have had an influence, but he was chastised severely for that.
We have a couple of minutes. Yes?
The LDS Church does have a history of some leaders who were more open. Brigham Young, whose children were educated by the Catholic clergy, and at a time when there were 30 bars open on Main Street. And David O. McKay, who was generally left in the community, Judy Brown, Bolding, and who was a minor official. But these are examples of people who were more open. And on the other hand, you have the developing rigidity of the church of your office. And at one time, the offices of the church were open to the public and other closed and guarded. But I wonder, from our Gentile panelists, if there's a sense that with President Hinckley, who seems to be a guy who's pretty secure and has a sense of humor and is more open, is there a sense you see of things opening up or closing down? Using Star Wars terminology, which forces is in the loop.
I'll share my anecdote. Recently, I was in Lent. Catholics get together, we have confession, and so I was with five other priests in a restaurant, all of us in full tackle. And we were talking about President Hinckley, and we were all agreeing that, you know, he's a wonderful man, and we like what he has to say, and gee, isn't he great? And we started looking at one another and say, well, what are we doing here in Utah? Maybe we should all convert. And so I think he's genuinely respected, certainly among clergy.
Damaris, Tom?
He's genuinely, he and his wife Marjorie are very much respected in the Jewish community. He's been very open with us.
I think he has a very human face, and for that I respect him and admire him greatly. I think it may be fair to make somewhat of a parallel with Pope John Paul II, who likewise has a very human face and socially just widely accepted. But when it comes down to the bottom line, in terms of being a conservator of the faith and the doctrines, I think President Hinckley is just as adamant and just as strong as the Pope would be. So I don't see any change. I love the appearance, the sociability, the likability, but I don't see any big changes.
But I think, Colin, that comes down to the point where there's absolute truth in certain things. I believe in that. And so when it's an absolute truth, I think President Hinckley will be absolute. As he